Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For nearly 25 years, prominent writers Ayelet Waldman and her husband Michael Chabon kept Israel and Palestine out of their private and public lives. But that all changed in 2014. Ayelet was invited to a writers' conference in Jerusalem, and while she was there, she met with former Israeli soldiers who opposed the occupation, their members of the group Breaking the Silence. They took Ayelet on a tour of Hebron and introduced her to members of Youth Against Settlements. And that experience really changed her life. After her eye-opening experience in Hebron and seeing and hearing about the daily lives of Palestinians living under occupation, she went to Tel Aviv just shortly after that. It's just an hour away from Hebron, and she says there she really felt at home. But she also felt that she bared some measure of responsibility for the crimes and injustice perpetrated in the name of that home. So Ayelet decided to break her silence. When she came back to the U.S., she told her husband, Michael, about her experience. And she described how disgusted she was when she saw graffiti scrawled on walls across Hebron, calling in Hebrew for the death of Arabs. They decided they had to do something. So they invited 23 writers to travel to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and write about their stories and the human cost of occupation. One of those writers, Fida Jereus, lives in the West Bank. Their stories are collected in the new anthology, Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. Ayelet Waldman is a renowned essayist and author of many books, including Occasional Moments of Grace and the Mommy Track Mystery Series. She's the editor of Inside This Place, Not Of It, Narratives from Women's Prisons. Ayelet's essay in this new book, Justice, Justice You Shall Pursue, focuses on interviews she conducted with young Palestinians who've been arrested or detained by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. And Ayelet joins us in studio. Hi, Ayelet. Thank you for coming back.
Oh, it's a real pleasure.
It's great.
And anything I can do during Pledge Week, so to help out one of my favorite stations in America.
Thank you so much. We're also joined today by Fida Jereus, a Palestinian writer and business consultant based in Ramallah. Fida has contributed to a number of publications, including This Week in Palestine and the Palestine Chronicle. She's the author of many books, including her forthcoming My Return to the Galilee, a memoir of her return to Israel after the Oslo Accords. And Fida also contributed to the book. Her essay is called Occupation's Untold Story, and Fida joins us from Ramallah. Hi, Fida. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. Well, I want to start with you, Ayelet. The last time we had you and Michael on, we talked about your eye-opening trip to Jerusalem and Hebron. And for people who didn't hear that trip, I just want to ask you, first off, why you decided not to write or even think about Israel and the settlements. You put that in the first section of your book, that you just didn't think about it, didn't want to talk about it.
You know, I think it's almost more important to answer that question, I have to tell you about my sort of family context. I mean, I was born in Israel. My father was, fought in the Israeli War of Independence in the Palmach. My brother, my older brother, is a very, very highly decorated soldier in the Israeli Defense Forces, one of the 200 or 300 most highly decorated soldiers. I have another brother who fought, who was in another unit. So I've been traveling back and forth to Israel my whole life. It was a really strange decision. I always assumed that Israel would play this incredibly important role in my life, in the life of my children, in the life of my family. And it wasn't like I boycotted. I mean, the first thing I did with my husband when I met him was say, you know what, if you're going to understand who I am, if you're going to plan on making a life with me, you really have to see this other country that plays such a huge part in my life. And I took him to Israel. That was the first trip we took. But over the course in the 2 decades that passed after that trip that we took together, Like I said, it wasn't like I boycotted. It was just simply that the news coming out from that part of the world is so miserable and so complicated and so messy and so dangerous to take a stand on that I just found myself checking out, which I think is a really common phenomenon for many Americans, especially American Jews, and especially American Jews who consider themselves progressive. Because if you are both progressive and you love Israel, you find yourself in this really uncomfortable position of wanting to support a place that continually violates your most deeply held beliefs. It felt hypocritical to me to be uncritical when it came to Israel. And at the same time, it felt too traumatic to be critical. So for a long time, I simply just, you know, didn't go. But then when I went to this book festival in Jerusalem and I asked the members of Breaking the Silence to take me on one of their trips. I mean, I can't even count the time. I mean, I've lived in Israel again and again in my life for 6 months here, a year there, a year there. I had never been to Hebron, which is crazy, and but also really common. I mean, there are Israelis who I've taken to Hebron who hadn't been there before in their lives. So, and the experience of being in Hebron, which is a city in which it's a Palestinian city in which 850 militant settlers have taken over different houses throughout this Palestinian city, and they're guarded by 650 Israeli soldiers. That they are guarded is somewhat ironic because. Though there is violence perpetrated against them, by far the vast majority of the violence is perpetrated by the settlers against the people of Hebron. Then when you walk through one of the main shopping streets in the city of Hebron, a street called Shuada Street, it's absolutely devoid of Palestinians. It's an empty street. The only people permitted to step foot on that street are Jews or people with foreign passports. And it's a street on which is flanked on both sides by Palestinian homes, by Palestinian shops that have been boarded up and closed by the Israeli army. And that's such a shocking and horrifying thing to see that I don't think anybody of good conscience could see that and not feel like they had a job to do.
You talked about why you and your husband hadn't talked about Israel or Palestine before. Why is it so controversial in your mind?
Well, you know, I mean, I think I take it back to like my summer camps growing up. So, I'm unusual as an American Jew in that I do have I was born in Israel. I have this very clear familial relationship. But for all American Jews, you know, Jews who grew up on the East Coast, most of us go to summer camp, and a lot here in the Bay Area, you know, Camp Tawanga up in Yosemite. And a big part of Jewish summer camp is celebrating the State of Israel. I mean, I don't think that's hard to understand considering that the specter of the Holocaust wasn't that long ago. I mean, you know, the vast majority of Jews of Europe were murdered. We have that kind of trauma that persists, and Israel was in many ways an answer to that trauma. So the celebration of Israel is ubiquitous in the lives of American Jews and Jews the world over. You know, Israel's Independence Day, which I didn't even know was called anything else, but of course in the Arab world and among Palestinians, that's called the Nakba, the great trauma, the great tragedy. And you know, but I was making little tiny Israeli flags in Hebrew school and at summer camp for Israel Independence Day. And then my kids, when they were in Hebrew school and summer camp, were making little tiny blue and white flags. And without any thinking that moment that was so important in my family's life, my father fought in that war and in the lives of Israelis and in the sort of cultural life of Israel, was to these other millions of people the greatest tragedy they'd ever experienced.
What has struck you the most about writing this book and going back to the West Bank to do a book launch and then doing another one in Berkeley? You've received some positive reviews, some negative reviews.
True.
the self-hating Jew thing has come up. What has,
and it's so funny that like any Jew who's critical of Israel is accused of being a self-hating Jew. I love myself. I love my Judaism. What I don't like is oppression. I don't think that makes me a self-hating Jew. I think that makes me a moral actor.
So what has come up with friends, family, your friends who live in Tel Aviv who have read this book? What are you hearing from them, especially the ones who've never been to Hebron, for example?
It was really one thing that I didn't expect and that was really both exhilarating and comforting and also in its own way tragic was how eagerly the left-wing Jewish community celebrated this book in Israel and how many Israelis came to our events and were just glad to be in the company of other people with who believe in justice. I think that it's really what I realized at that moment, sitting in these rooms full of hundreds and hundreds of Israeli activists, people who devote themselves, some of them single-mindedly without any other activity in their lives, to ending the occupation. Others for whom it's an important part of their identity, but also who simply can't live in a world where their country in their name continues to behave in these ways. I think the thing that I realized there is that change, particularly the end to an occupation, seems impossible until the moment that it happens. I mean, colonialism and oppression and occupation, they can last for a while, but they cannot persist forever. And eventually things will change. And so when I was sitting in those rooms full of Palestinian activists, full of Israeli activists, what I felt like was not, here I am with the last remnants of the Israeli left. No, I felt like here I am with these remarkably courageous harbingers of the change that is to come. The question is, I'm 52 years old. I hope I see that change. Lots can happen, in the next decades. But but it's also possible that, we'll be fighting this fight and my children will be fighting it. And I just hope my grandchildren won't have to.
Today we're speaking with Ayelet Waldman about the book she and her husband, Michael Chabon, edited, Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. They reached out to 23 writers to travel to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and write about their stories and the human cost of occupation. One of those writers, Fida Jerides, lives in the West Bank, and Fida joins us from Ramallah. Hi, Fida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Fida, it's so wonderful to talk to you. It's been a while since we've seen each other.
It is indeed. Thanks, Ayelet. Same here.
Fida, you were here in Berkeley with Ayelet and Michael for the book launch in June. Before we talk about what this experience has been like for you, talk about what happened when you were initially contacted and learned about Ayelet and Michael's story.
Okay, I first heard about the book from one of the people that they interviewed for the book, Sam Bahour. Michael wrote his essay about Sam in the book. And Sam and I were colleagues, we worked together, and he brought the book to my attention, and then I reached out, he reached out to Ayelet and Michael and made the connection. When I first heard about the book, I was very, very excited about the prospect, and especially about the fact that it was bringing in people from different nationalities from all around the world to lend a voice to what is happening here. When I got on board, I began to see that, it was a very professional, very conscientious effort to really bring people here to see the situation for themselves and, and at the same time not tell them what to write in any way. These writers would come from various places and spend time here, and then they would form their own impressions and go back to their respective countries to write on any aspect of what they saw that pulled them, or that they found, particularly, let's say, interesting, or that pulled them into writing about it. So all in all, it was, a great idea, a great experience, and I was very, very happy to take part.
Fida, you have a very interesting story. Your father was born, he's from the village of Fasuta in the Galilee. It's a few kilometers from the Lebanese border. And you were born in Lebanon and then moved to Cyprus. after the Oslo Agreement, you went back to the Galilee. Tell us a little bit about your family history and how they ended up in Lebanon.
Okay, my father was 10 years old when the Nakba took place. He was born, as you said, in Fasuta, which is a tiny village very near the Lebanese border. He went on to study law in the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he grew up under, obviously, military governance at the time, which was a system that was exclusively against the Arab population that had remained, or the Palestinian population that had remained in the newly created state of Israel. Military governance was a very, very tough reality to live in. People were watched, with a hawk-like type of diligence. They needed permits to go everywhere. Freedom of expression was denied. It was, difficult times. He grew up with the awareness of all this, and at the same time with the awareness of the Nakba and what had happened. As a child, he had actually seen people being forced to leave from surrounding villages. And he had witnessed, the emptying of several villages around Fasuta. So he grew up very conscious of what was happening around him. And in his 20s, he co-founded Al-Ard, which was one of the first resistance movements at the time. In Israel, Palestinian resistance movements. And from there, he was, hounded in his work. Things got very difficult. He kept being detained and put under house arrest together with his friends and colleagues. And the situation continued until in 1970, he was forced. It was a kind of voluntary expulsion. He was more or less forced to leave. Otherwise, he was, told that he would be put away for a long time. And so it was that, he and my late mother left and ended up in Lebanon, where he joined the PLO, and he became the director of the Palestine Research Center. And I was born in Lebanon together with my brother. We stayed there until the Israeli invasion in 1982, and then in 1983 there was a bomb attack on the center, which killed 8 employees, including my mother, and tons of passersby. This was in February 1983. It was after the Sabra and Shatila massacres and after the Palestinian fighters had been evicted from the camps and from Beirut. We were, a few months later, in June 1983, we were among the last Palestinians to leave. We left to Cyprus. A number of Palestinian cultural institutions moved there with us, and the research center was reopened there. We grew up, my brother and I, never ever thinking that we would be able to come back to Palestine or to our village. I mean, this was something completely impossible to think of. And then when the Oslo Accords happened, of course, this became a reality and we could come back. But we were among very few people that could actually do this, because there was a small stipulation in the Accords that allowed for certain members of the PLO, Palestinians who had held Israeli citizenship before leaving Israel, to come back and, get their ID again and go back to their towns or villages inside Israel. But this was a very small number of people. We're less than 10 people, I think, who exercised this right. So when I came back, I had really, it was the most shocking experience of my life, because in 24 hours, given my personal history, my family history, in 24 hours, I literally became an Israeli citizen. I had to learn Hebrew. I had to integrate. I had to go to work in Israeli companies, use the banks, the hospitals, everything. And I had no one to talk to who had gone through a similar experience as mine and returned in the same way.
Fida, we have a pretty good line, but I just want to make sure listeners heard this. And you write about this in your essay in the book Kingdom of Olives and Ash. In 1983, when you were 10 years old, you lost your mom to a bombing of the Palestine Liberation Organization Research Center in Beirut in the fallout of the Israeli invasion the year before.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ayelet, when you connected with Fida and she told you about her story, what was your initial reaction?
Amazement. Amazement and awe that someone whose mother was murdered in this kind of attack would have the capacity and the generosity and the grace to continue to struggle for a peaceful resolution, that she would become one of my dear friends. I, an Israeli who was born in Israel, whose father fought on the other side of that conflict in 1948. I mean, Fida is an example to me of what is the greatest capacity of humanity, and that is she is both tenacious and ideologically committed and capable of astonishing forgiveness. She's a role model for me in all ways.
Thank you, Ayelet. Thank you so much.
Ayelet, reading Fida's story, I think Fida and I are about the same age, and did you know, I mean, what it's like for her on a regular basis to try to rent an apartment, to try on a dress in a mall? I mean, basic things that we don't even think about here, and how she is discriminated against on a regular basis. And Fida, I'll ask you to tell a couple stories, but Ayelet, did you realize that this happens on a daily basis there?
To my shame, I both realized and didn't. And didn't let myself realize, I think it's better, more accurate to say. I knew all those things were true. I could imagine those things, and I did my very best to simply not think about them. I mean, sometimes it's inevitable that you think about them. I remember once when I was living in Jerusalem, I lost my contact lens at work one day, and a young man who worked, I worked folding laundry in a laundromat, and another employee who was Palestinian drove me back to my apartment to get a replacement contact lens. And the next day there was a note written on my door in Hebrew from a neighbor telling me that they were horrified that I had brought Arabs into the building. So I had confronted it, but I don't think I really truly understood the day-to-day humiliation. I mean, the thing that's so remarkable about Fida's essay and Fida's story is that Fida was living in Israel, you know, a Palestinian citizen of Israel, and she left Israel to move to the occupied territories in order to feel a modicum of personal liberty. I mean, think about that. Mm. That's horrifying.
Fida, your essay, Occupation's Untold Story, starts off by sharing an experience of what it was like to try to get an apartment halfway between your village and Naharia, a small seaside town in the Galilee. Yeah. You wanted to be close to your parents, your work, and the beach at the same time. Mm-hmm. Tell us what that experience was like in trying to rent that apartment.
Okay, the group of buildings was new. I mean, it was on the way sort of from my village to Naharia, and at the time I was working in Tefin, which is an industrial complex in the Galilee, again near my village and near this apartment complex that I had been seeing, you know, every day when I drove past. And so when the signs came up, you know, that apartments were available for rent, I went in to, you know, to try my luck and to ask about how much it would cost and if I could rent a place there. And I met the superintendent of the, you know, of the premises, and, you know, she reacted immediately with suspicion, because when we speak Hebrew, you know, no matter how fluent we are at it, we still have an accent. And so she can usually tell from the accent. She hadn't yet asked my name, but she can usually tell from the accent that, you know, I'm not Jewish, I'm a Palestinian citizen of Israel. And so she, you know, she couldn't tell me, I think. It was a case of she wasn't really able to tell me straight out that, sorry, we don't rent to Palestinians or to Arabs. So she entertained me. She took the keys and she showed me an apartment. And I told her, okay, this is very small. Don't you have something, you know, a little bit larger? And she said, no, this is all that's available, which struck me as odd because it was literally, you know, recently built and full of empty units. So I didn't say anything, but I began to get the feeling that something was wrong. And then she said, listen, I'm going to have to talk to the neighbors to see if it would be okay to rent to you here. And if it is, then we can proceed. And I said, you know, what do you mean? Because, you know, she'd asked me where I was from, and I said, from Fasuta. And she said, well, you know, there hadn't really been a case so far of us renting to Arabs here. So I'm going to have to check with the neighbors to see if it's okay. So I just turned around and I thanked her and I left. Mm. I didn't return.
And you write that that was one of the many reasons that you found yourself not so long after that moving to Ramallah in the West Bank.
Yeah, I mean, which, you know, as Ayelet says, it's very strange if you think about it, that one would move from a supposed, you know, free and liberal country to live voluntarily under, you know, military occupation. But I was tired of, you know, at every single turn of being treated like a second or even a tenth class citizen. It just, there is a point at which you just can't take it anymore. Other Palestinians who were born in Israel and who grew up there have tragically become very accustomed to this, to the point where it's become a de facto part of life. So, you know, in many cases, they don't really question it anymore. That's just the way things are. But it was extremely difficult for me because I'd come from outside, and I'd also come with my own baggage, with my own history and my past. And on the flip side also, I'd lived, you know, in Britain, I'd studied there, I'd, you know, grown up in Cyprus, I knew what a really free and equal society looked like, or at least, you know, in principle, and how people, you know, were to react to others, you know, on the basis of equality and so on. And so seeing this, just it was just, it blew my mind, and I actually kept at it for 8 years before finally giving up.
You know, there's recently a case that I think was is a really telling case for Americans because it touches upon our own history. There was very recently a case of a town pool that was open to residents from the whole area. Mm-hmm. And that whole geographical area included both settlements and Jewish settlements in the occupied territories and one or two Palestinian villages. Mm-hmm. And I believe the man was a physician, a Palestinian physician, and his family sought to join the pool. Mm-hmm. And the pool went through these elaborate contortions they changed all of the rules of admission in order to preclude a single Palestinian family, because to the Jews who swam in that pool, the idea of sharing swimming water with someone they think of as an Arab is disgusting to them. So we know that's something that happened very recently in American history, and it's so visceral and so horrifying that I think it's something that it's impossible as a person of good conscience, as a person who considers herself devoted to equality, to see such instances like that and not realize, oh, I'm talking about segregation. I'm talking about, to use the word that Israelis hate more than any other, apartheid. I'm talking about a system so deeply unjust that I cannot possibly support it with my dollars and my votes.
Mm-hmm. Today we are speaking with Jewish writer Ayelet Waldman and Palestinian writer Fida Jireas. They're discussing the new book, Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. And Fida is joining us from Ramallah in the West Bank. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, joined in studio here by Maliha Razazan, producer of Your Call, asking for your support for local public radio. The number to call, 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. We do have the book that's being discussed on today's program, Kingdom of Olives and Ash, which is edited by Michael Chabon and Rose's guest today, Ayelet Waldman. Yours for a $120 contribution to KALW.
And I love what Ayelet just said, the change and end to the occupation will come. And occupation and colonialism cannot persist forever. This is a very, very hopeful note about a very seemingly hopeless situation. And if you support this kind of programming that is complex, it's nuanced, it's heartfelt, it's on the ground reporting and writing by some of the most celebrated writers in the world, do support KLW, 1-800-525-9917. You can pledge securely online at klw.org.
800-525-9917 or klw.org. This book is a collection of writers who confront the occupation, who are bearing witness, talking about what they see, telling their truth as they perceive it and bringing it to you. That is part of what happens here on Your Call. You hear from journalists and activists and citizens who simply say, I want to talk about what I see and I want to try to make change. Your support at 800-525-9917 or KALW.org keeps this kind of a conversation going. We're going back to the program in just 15 seconds.
1-800-525-9917. If you get this book, you will enjoy reading it. 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
KALW.org, 800-525-9917. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Jewish writer Ayelet Waldman and Palestinian writer Fia Jedaeus, discussing the new book, Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. For nearly 25 years, Ayelet and her husband Michael Chabon kept Israel and Palestine out of their lives. But it all changed when Ayelet was invited to a writers' conference in Jerusalem in 2014, and she met with former Israeli soldiers who opposed the occupation. They're members of Breaking the Silence. They took her on a tour of Hebron, and her life really changed forever since then. She had such an eye-opening experience. She came back, told her husband about what she saw, and they decided to do something. They invited 23 writers to travel to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to write about their stories and the human cost of occupation. And one of those writers, Fida Jedaeus, lives in Ramallah in the West Bank, and she's joining us also today to talk about her essay. And you can join us if you have any questions for Ayelet or Fida, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Fida, before the break, you were talking about what it was like to try to rent an apartment in Israel. And in your essay, you write that most people living outside of Israel and even Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza do not know much about Palestinian citizens of Israel. You write, we are assumed to be the same as citizens of any other country and to be able to live normal lives. Talk about some of the other experiences you had, things that happened on a regular basis at work, things that happened when you went shopping for dresses.
Yes, I mean, like I said, it's, you know, it's a case of never really being able to forget, you know, your racial background. One, you know, a couple of the things I mentioned in the essay, for example, when I was at work, a colleague, you know, came up to me and he was just standing at the door and sipping his coffee, and he said to me, I had been recently in my first computer job in Israel, and I'd been there for about, I think, a couple of months. And this colleague just stood there, and he kind of looked at me, you know, quizzically, and then he said, wow, you know, all due respect, you're not like the other Arabs, huh? You've made something of yourself. And I had no idea what to do with that comment. I just kind of stared at him almost open-mouthed, thinking, you know, did I imagine what he just said? But, you know, sadly, I didn't. And, you know, in the mall, I mean, you know, there's a whole repertoire of things that happen that, you know, you don't, again, sadly, we almost stop thinking about them. But they come to mind, like when you, you know, go into a shop, even if we're speaking in Arabic, our voices tend to subconsciously drop because of the perceived, you know, negative connotation against the Arabic language and against Palestinians. Once I was, you know, I also say this in the essay, I was trying on a dress and, you know, I came out of the fitting room and, of course, you know, this is lady wants to flatter you and, you know, obviously is trying to sell. But she goes, wow, that's so pretty and you look so nice, you know, one would never think you were an Arab. You know, you would just not believe that you're an Arab. And I just, again, you know, I was just flabbergasted. You have no idea what to say in these situations. Mm.
Well, we have a couple of callers on the line. Let's hear from Basil in San Francisco. Hi, Basil. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having this and for Ayelet's book. I've been a big fan of Michael Chabon. And the question I have for you is, what is your hope for how people should relate to Zionism and the necessity for establishing Israel in Palestine as an exclusivist state that doesn't include all of its native inhabitants?
You know, it's really that's a really good question and a really complicated question. So, you know, sometimes I think the word Zionism is even more fraught than the word feminism. So, when I was growing up, my parents, who were both politically left,
they taught me, you know, they raised me as a Zionist. And to them, the word Zionist meant purely that you believed that there should be a state in the Middle East, in the land that's now the Israeli state, that is that where Jews can go. Not necessarily governed exclusively by Jews, but a state where Jews would, it's sort of like the escape hatch. That's a really different definition of Zionism than the vast majority of people have. And it took sort of growing up and understanding what that word meant. I mean, you know, when I teach my children about this, and it's really complicated because on the one hand, you know, Jews are, like all people, entitled to a homeland, a place where they can be safe and where they can experience security. But this place, Israel, which is a place that it's true the Jews have gone for, you know, thousands of years, there were people living there. You know, the comfortable lessons of Zionism that I learned when I was a child was that it was an empty land, devoid of people, and we just took a bit of empty land. And that's just not true. You know, this was a place where people lived, where people had a, you know, there was an entire cultural, racial, ethnic universe. And to say that you know, the Germans killed 6 million Jews, so now this small group of Palestinians have to make room for a different country, I mean, it's not something that we would think was even remotely acceptable right now. But the fact is that there are millions and millions of Jews living in Israel, and that there is now a Jewish state there. And what are we going to do about that? So I believe there is a way to be Zionist, to believe that the state of Israel should continue, that it should continue with its Jewish flavor, and a way to believe in the principles of social justice. It's not easy by any means, but there is a way forward. And there are people of good conscience who see ways forward. I personally resist taking public positions on issues that I think of as the negotiated terms of resolving the conflict. I just don't have the expertise. I limit my sort of public conversation primarily to issues of occupation, because that's a no-brainer to me. You know, how this situation where two different peoples are going to reside on essentially the same small piece of land, that's an issue that's going to take negotiation, and it's going to take the wisest minds. How we are going to end the illegal, criminal occupation, brutal, violent occupation of millions of people in the West Bank and Gaza, which is still, even though the Israelis aren't there, they govern it completely through force. That's not hard. You know how you do that? You just stop.
Fida, what would you add? In your essay, you write that to really look at ending the occupation, the issue at hand is much larger. It's in Israel's self-definition, its expansionist goals, its attitude toward non-Jews, and its actions over the last 68 years that attest to all of this.
Yes, I mean, it's a wider issue to me. I mean, the occupation, as I say in the essay, it's really one facet, if you like, of this largely exclusionist approach or belief that really centers around only a Jewish nature or a Jewish character of the state, and really extremely excludes anybody else. Now, given the reality we're in, and given that two people still live on this land, you can't really achieve any lasting peace by continuing to build barriers and walls and just, you know, pummeling people with violence and with war once every few months or every few years. That's never going to get anybody any lasting peace. It's only going to increase the trauma and the bitterness and resentment and anger on both sides, and ultimately the cycle of violence will just perpetrate itself. So I think that there's a very, very big leap that needs to be made, and the whole, you know, character of the state and the whole exclusionist, you know, approach or principles that it lives by. And this is a big, big, big pill to have to swallow.
I think that I want to be clear. I think Fida is absolutely 100% right. When I say that I don't engage on that subject, it's simply because I don't believe that I have the competence. But again, as from a purely moral point of view, treating different people who live and who have the same passport differently based purely on their race is completely reprehensible and not something that any of us should support.
Michael, last time he was on the show, said he supports ending the United States funding Israel. What is it, about $3.5 billion,
$4 billion
a year? Do you also support ending that funding?
You know, if that funding went to the goals of establishing peaceful coexistence and making it possible, I mean, $4 billion is a lot of dollars. You know, you could invest that every year. You could invest that really wisely in furthering the goals of peaceful coexistence, in bringing the greatest minds to bear on what a government would look like that would give actual real equality and rights, civil and human rights, to all people who live in within the greater boundaries of Israel-Palestine. I would absolutely support American investment in that venture. Do I support American investment in continuing a brutal occupation and the continued denial of civil and human rights, not just to the Palestinians in the occupied territories, but in Israel proper? No, I absolutely don't.
Today we are speaking with Jewish writer Ayelet Waldman and Palestinian writer Fida Jererus, discussing the new book, Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. Thank you again, Basil, for calling. Let's go next to Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you for this. There's a lot to unpack here. And I'm just wondering if you and Fida see the resolution differently. And Ayala, if you also think of Israel as a Jewish state and a democratic one, is there an inherent contradiction in that statement? And if there is, then what is the future of Israel then say to you?
So, Mo, you are pushing me, as Fida does, out of my comfortable, safe space of opposing occupation into confronting the complexities of the larger conflict. Okay, at this point in time, I believe, as others wiser minds than I, believe that there is a way forward that can both make real the aspirations of Jews for a homeland where they can be safe from prosecution and persecution, and make real the aspirations of Palestinians for a homeland where they can feel safe from persecution and prosecution. I believe that is possible. The situation gets ever more complex, purely from a geographical point of view. Israel has never stopped its settlement project, but its expansionism has never abated, even when the ostensible facts on the ground were that settlement wasn't continuing and that it wasn't expanding. So it gets more and more difficult with every year and with every expansion to imagine a possibility, either a two-state solution or a one democratic state solution, which, frankly, I was a lawyer trained at Harvard Law School, with a deep devotion to the constitutions and the principles that underpin it. So my ideal situation, personally, Ayelet Waldman's ideal situation for Israel-Palestine, would be a single state that was jointly governed. But I also am, if a two-state solution, for the time being, I think there is a way forward with a two-state solution. It just gets ever more unlikely with every day that passes. But Fida is far more sophisticated an analyst than I am, and has a far deeper understanding of what it would demand to make that possible. And I think she should answer that question.
Fida?
Thank you, Ayelet. You give me a little bit too much credit there, but thank you. Okay, so it's my answer to the Jewish and democratic state. I think I'm just going to say it straight out. I think, yes, it's an inherent contradiction. You cannot keep those two words in one sentence, given there are non-Jews living in Israel, and still make it a democratic state. A democratic state needs to be a state for all its citizens, irrespective of color, race, creed, and so on. Now, whether we move towards a two-state ultimately or a one-state solution, the Jewish and democratic principle remains a problem, because if it's two states, then Israel still has to deal with its Palestinian minority who are Israeli citizens. And if it's one state, then obviously Jewish and democratic will still mean, you know, a system of control that's put in place, which, you know, prohibits the ideal we have of, let's say, shared governance and, you know, according to democratic ideas. So my view on it, I think, you know, reflects that of most Palestinians, that yes, there is an inherent contradiction that would make it very difficult to truly work on inclusive terms and make it a country for all the people that live in it, for equal rights.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Mo. Let's go to John in San Francisco.
To Rose and to your guest, I have two questions, and I'll try to make them as simple as I can. What is the qualification for the passport notation as to nationality or ethnicity? Is there a conflict between the two? And the second is, there is a problem with, you know, long-term secularization of Israel, despite the differential growth rates between ultra-Orthodox and secular Jews in Israel.
I didn't understand the first part of your question, John.
Well, I think there's been a recent dispute over how Israelis should be described on their passports, whether Jewish or Israeli. And I think it was really recently decided on being Jewish, which is a means of excluding others.
Okay. Fida or Ayla?
My Israeli passport doesn't say anything about me being Jewish. It doesn't. Fida, the Tudat Zehut, does it have a notation for Jew or Palestinian?
No, I don't think so.
You know, however, it's interesting whether it actually, you know, technically says it or not. It's you know, to have an official document that's a Jew on it is something that, you know, given our cultural and historical context, would be very problematic and would terrify, I think. I just don't think that it's something that that would be tolerated, although I could be wrong. And I'm not looking at my Israeli passport right now in front of me, but I'm pretty confident that it doesn't say that I'm Jewish. But, you know, you don't have to say that. Fida only had to walk into a building, and because of her accent, because of her name, it was clear to which group she belonged. There's also, you know, Israel is struggling with this notion of Jew versus non-Jew, not just with its Palestinian communities. I mean, you know, it's struggling with it because they're refugees from Eritrea, from Sudan. Israel has given precisely one Sudanese refugee actual status, and this is a remarkable young man who's now in law school. But there are, you know, many others. There are communities that have been brought to Israel. Some of them, you know, there was the sort of definitional struggles. I mean, there are groups of Ethiopian Jews who define themselves as Jews, and when these people were brought and integrated, albeit not particularly successfully, because of inherent racism and bias, into Israeli communities, there are many who demanded that they convert because they didn't recognize them as legitimate Jews. On the other hand, when there was groups brought from the former Soviet Union into Israel, many of them with the most tenuous of connection to Judaism, you know, ethnic connection, genetic connection, connection of cultural identity, they didn't experience the same level of bias and discrimination that the Ethiopian Jews. So, you know, Israel, this notion of what it means to be a Jewish state causes continual complex and upset within you know, the governance of that country and the definition of that country. So it isn't purely limited to Palestinians.
Fida, we only have a couple of minutes left, and you also in your essay write about the difference between being called an Arab and a Palestinian. And you write that Palestinian citizens of Israel are still trying to come to terms with their own identity. In recent years, we've begun to cautiously say we're Palestinian again as the wheel continues to grind on decades of Israeli oppression and our patience wears thinner and thinner. Fida, what else do you want listeners to know about the movements that are taking place in the West Bank, the BDS movement, for example? Anything else you'd like us to know at a time when, because of what's happening in Washington, you know, we're not really getting that much news about the West Bank and Gaza unless we really look for it?
Mm-hmm. I think by and large, things here are looking as grim as ever in terms of the government and its policies and its attitude towards continuing with settlement projects and continuing to repress and oppress people on both sides of the Green Line in different ways, of course. Here, you know, in the West Bank, it's much more blatant. But I think my message to people from the U.S., especially when I was there, you know, doing the book launches and so on, is, you know, for people to really try and make themselves better informed. You know, sometimes as simply as just, you know, doing proper internet searches in proper venues that can give you the information, not merely, you know, relying, you know, as we were speaking earlier about media in the U.S., which tends to slant things only in a certain way. So I think for the large, you know, portion of the public, just getting more informed. I mean, even something as simple as reading Haaretz, which is, you know, the mainstream left-wing Israeli newspaper, gives you so much more of the true reality of what's really going on. And I think that really, you know, is a first step for everything else, for people being able to realize, you know, first of all, what's going on, and then to take steps to support it, or to, you know, be activists, or to do whatever, you know, they feel that they can do in their part towards helping to resolve this conflict and to restore peace. I think that's my take, you know, after coming to the States recently.
And Ayelet, brief final thoughts?
Well, I think subscribing to Haaretz is a wonderful recommendation. It's the Israeli newspaper. It's written in Hebrew and English. I think that don't do what Michael and I did. Don't spend two decades with your head in the sand. Engage, and engage in a way that doesn't compromise your own values.
Ayelet Waldman is editor of the book Kingdom of Olives and Ash. She also contributed an essay about children in Israeli jails. And we've also been joined by Fida Jireyas. She lives in Ramallah in the West Bank, and she also contributed an essay to Kingdom of Olives and Ash. Ayelet and Fida, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.